Studio 360.
One of Carole King and Jerry Goffin's biggest hits was The Locomotion for Little Eva. It went to number one in 1962. And it wasn't just a song. It was a dance involving swinging your hips, jumping up, jumping back, making a chain, and then a chug-a-chug motion like a railroad train. I'm doing it right here in the studio. It's a shame you can't see me. Anyhow, the early 60s were all about fad dance songs, like Chubby Checker's The Twist and the Olympics' Hully Gully. But it's another would-be fad song from that era, one I'm betting you don't know, that fascinates our producer, Evan Chung. It came out at the end of 1961 and promptly fell into oblivion, until a copy wound up in Evan's hands.
I grabbed it out of some neglected rack of dusty 45s in a Chicago record store. It must have been the title that caught my eye, Mugmates, because what is a mugmate? So I brought it over to the listening station and dropped the needle.
I go for coffee.
Yay, 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 yay.
You go for coffee.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
We both go for coffee. So let's be mugmates. Yay, 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 mugmates.
I mean, how can you not love this song? Or be completely baffled by it? Because the singer Eddie Hodges goes on to explain exactly what mugmates are.
The newest craze in the teenage world is a mug marked his and hers. So my darling, meet me in the coffee shop and we'll do what everyone does.
What everyone does? Really? If you missed it, being mugmates, apparently, is the practice of a teenage couple decorating a pair of matching coffee mugs to show they're going steady. Like a ceramic promise ring, I guess. And if the song is to be believed, his and hers mugs were the latest craze in the teenage world, which is a claim you hear all the time in songs from this era, that some craze has spread, passed from teenager to teenager, like mono.
Just a matter of a few days, yeah. Kids, dance became the new teenage craze.
The dance fads are the most famous ones, the Jerk, the Swim, the Popeye Joe. But there are also songs about how all the kids these days are hula hooping, or surfing, or fraternizing in sleepwear.
Don't you know it's the latest craze, having a party wearing your PJs?
I always wonder about the claims made in these songs. Was there really a phenomenon around the Watusi and the mashed potato and they just had to write a song about it? Or was it the other way around? Did they make up a dance, which then became a craze because of the song? It's the age-old question. What came first, the funky chicken or the egg? I actually found an answer for the most famous example.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
There never was a dance, the locomotion, until after it was a number one hit record and everybody says, how does this dance go? So Little Eva had to make up a dance.
That's Carole King in 1981. But I get why a songwriter would invent a fake dance. You convince teens that everybody else is already doing it, the teens start requesting the song, the dance actually becomes a craze, you sell a bunch of records, and then you live easy for the rest of your life on your turkey trot royalties. But how do you explain mugmates? What's the angle here? I mean, it just seems like such a bonkers and specific social practice to invent. Using a matched pair of paint-it-yourself coffee mugs as an emblem of romantic exclusivity among teenagers? How is that even supposed to work logistically? Where do you keep these mugs? Are you just supposed to carry them around with you in your knapsack at all times? Did teenagers even drink coffee anyway? I needed to find out. Was mugmates ever a thing, even for a moment? And if not, why would someone want to make it a thing?
Hello.
Hi, is this Eddie?
Yeah.
So I called up someone who might know something about it. Eddie Hodges, the guy who sang Milkmaids.
Oh, gosh. That's heaven. That was a long time ago, man.
So how old would you have been in 1962?
Oh, let's see. Probably about 14 or 15.
Now, even by that age, Eddie was already a seasoned veteran.
Well, I started singing when I was very young. People kind of knew me as the singing kid.
You know that little kid, Eddie Hodges, who lives upstairs?
Yeah.
Sings great. I'm going to bring him down to Joe the bartender and sing for the gang down there.
This is Eddie on The Honeymooners in 1952. Eddie ended up a very successful child star. His career was built on a chain reaction of fortunate run-ins and chance encounters. It started when a stranger stopped him on the street in Times Square.
A lady asked me where I got my red hair. I said it came with my head, and she started laughing and gave me her card, and she said to call the number on the card. So we called the number on the card, and it was the Name That Tune office.
Name That Tune!
Now back tonight and trying for $20,000 are Eddie Hodges, the 10-year-old schoolboy, and his partner, Major John Glenn Jr., the Marine Corps jet pilot.
Before he was the first American in orbit, John Glenn was Eddie's Name That Tune partner. Coincidentally, they were on the show the same day as the Sputnik launch.
Eddie, would you like to take a trip to the moon?
No, sir, I like it fine right here.
The John Glenn, Eddie Hodges team won 5 weeks in a row and split a $50,000 grand prize. The real jackpot for Eddie, though, was that a Broadway composer happened to be watching. After the show, he called Eddie up to ask him to audition for a new musical.
And they had me say some lines, and they said, now do it with a lisp, and I didn't know what a lisp was, so they told me how to do that. So I read the lines from the paper with a lisp. And they offered me the part of Winthrop in The Music Man.
Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, let me say it once again.
Have you ever been to Gary, Indiana?
No, I never have. Never been to Gary. Be kind of neat.
The Music Man was a smash hit, and Eddie spent over a year starring on Broadway, which led to the next lucky break.
Frank Sinatra came to see the show and offered me the movie role in A Hole in the Head.
Cause he had high hopes. He had high hopes.
After A Hole in the Head was The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Of course, I'll have to go down the river to New Orleans first. Wouldn't that be the beatenest, Jim? New Orleans.
It was just a constant run of things after that.
After conquering Broadway, television, and the movies, in 1961, Eddie added teen pop star to his resume.
I had a really nice hit record called I'm Gonna Knock on Your Door.
I'm gonna knock on your door, ring on your bell, tap on your window too.
Now, after all the career-making run-ins, the talent scout, the astronaut, the Broadway composer, Old Blue Eyes, now came the strangest encounter. Do you remember how they presented this song to you?
Yeah.
A few months after he hit the pop charts, Eddie and his producer got paid a visit from a group of men. They were representatives of an organization.
They said that there was this song suggesting that teenagers decorate their own mugs. People could put their names on them and paint them and put pictures on them, that kind of thing. They said people could be mug mates. And I said, well, that's kind of catchy. That's interesting. We went in the studio and cut it.
Instead of carving our initials on an old oak tree, I've got a better plan. We'll use two coffee mugs, one for you, one for me. I know you'll understand that'll make us mug mates.
Eddie recorded the song for this organization, and it was the last he ever heard from them.
Nothing ever happened. I never heard anything about it after that.
So no interviews, no nothing?
Nothing.
It seems like a lot of effort to write this song and find someone to record it and then just to do nothing with it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know what happened. We never did find out.
So who were these people that recruited Eddie to sing that Mugmates was the latest craze and then vanished?
It seems to me that this organization were an organization of coffee growers, maybe. I don't even remember the name of it.
Whoever this group was, I knew they had an interest in reaching teenagers. So I consulted the most authoritative source I could think of on the subject, back issues of 17 magazine. In between articles like, "What does his handwriting show about him?" In my case, hesitancy and a certain lack of confidence, I found a series of full-page ads touting even more outlandish claims in the song. That mugmates are busting out all over. That the niftiest party idea of the season is a BYOM party, bring your own mugmate. That the new after-prom ritual is a mugmate breakfast. Allegedly, mugmates had become such a craze, they had to issue a special warning to girls about the mugmate Lothario, a fellow who can't resist playing the field, a gay deceiver who collects hearts, and who has a mantle full of mugmates to prove it. And, in small print, at the bottom of each page, it said, "For a free folder of mugmate inspirations and simple directions, write to the Pan American Coffee Bureau." So I had my answer. But what exactly was the Pan American Coffee Bureau? Why were they meddling in the courtship rituals of high school students? And what gave them the idea that they could just invent a cultural practice and people would adopt it? Well, it turns out, because they'd actually done it before.
Producer Evan Chung's quest to uncover the mysterious origins of the Mugmate song.
It turns out this so-called craze was brewed up by something called the Pan American Coffee Bureau, which I learned was an organization funded by the 10 coffee-growing nations of South and Central America. But why? Why would Brazil and Colombia and Costa Rica pool their resources and invest them in this? Convincing teenage sweethearts in the U.S. that they should have decorated mugs to show that they're going steady. To figure it out, I had to learn a bit more about the organization's history.
The Pan American Coffee Bureau grew out of the fact that coffee was really struggling in those days. The coffee growers were being hammered.
Mark Pendergrast is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World.
Americans weren't drinking as much coffee as the people in Brazil and the other countries wanted.
Now, there was a good reason why North Americans were buying less coffee then.
Because the coffee was so terrible.
This coffee is criminal.
Coffee roasters were peddling blends of cheap, low-quality beans.
Your coffee just doesn't taste any good.
And they were also brewing it with percolators.
Listen to it perk.
Which is a terrible way to drink coffee.
What's wrong with the coffee?
Bad taste.
Even worse than the percolated stuff was the instant coffee.
This is coffee?
So it was kind of a disaster.
Pretty harsh.
Well, so's your coffee.
They were cheapening their blend.
Gets worse every day.
They were losing market share.
Oh, no.
They were basically floundering around, not knowing what to do.
In stepped the Pan American Coffee Bureau with a solution.
In 1952, they came up with the idea of the coffee break.
Everyone from the janitor up to the general manager grabs a cup and we stop for the coffee break.
Here's the pitch. In the middle of the workday, if everybody at the office stepped away from their desks for 10 minutes, had a cup of joe, it would boost morale and improve productivity.
Coffee break!
The Coffee Bureau had a $2 million annual budget to convince people that the coffee break was the new trend. And it worked.
A coffee break is almost an American institution.
Within 4 years, 73% of all American workers were taking coffee breaks.
Coffee break!
The Bureau had made coffee breaks a thing, basically out of nothing. More coffee breaks meant more coffee was being sold. Consumption was up. Mission accomplished. Except there was a problem.
Their advertising was aimed almost exclusively at adults.
Young people were actually drinking less coffee now.
The image of coffee was that it was a boring product for adult business people and housewives, not something that you were going to drink as a teenager.
Now, why was this a problem? Well, because there were a hell of a lot of teenagers all of a sudden. The first wave of the baby boom was in high school now, and it marked the birth of true teenage culture. They had their own music, their own movies.
Packed with the dangerous thrills of hot-blooded youngsters showing off to hot rod girls.
Their own cars, and they had their own money, which increasingly they were spending on something more fun-seeming than coffee.
Come alive, you're in the Pepsi generation.
What they wanted was to have girlfriends and love and energy, and that's what was being conveyed by the Coca-Cola and the Pepsi ads.
Who is the Pepsi generation? Just about everyone with the young view of things. Active, livelier people with a liking for Pepsi-Cola.
Many advertisers were telling the coffee people, look, you have to do something because the sodas are eating your lunch.
The president of the National Coffee Association even wrote a deliciously overwrought article in the Tea and Coffee Trade Journal warning his colleagues of the dire situation they had on their hands.
The very thought of it conjures up to me the vision of a modern Pied Piper of Hamelin. Today, the Pied Piper is a man fashioned of metal and glass. His torso is one giant cola bottle, and his limbs are formed of soft drink and beer cans, strung loosely so that he makes a lot of noise as he walks through the marketplace with our youth flocking after him. Coffee, thus far, has no such Pied Piper.
But I wondered, was it just a marketing problem? Or could it be biological? Is there actually something innate in teenagers that makes them hate coffee and like Coke?
It's one of the most fundamental mysteries, is why do we like the foods and beverages we do?
Julie Manella is a researcher at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia.
I'm a developmental biopsychologist, so I study the biological basis of behavior.
Her research focuses on how taste develops in young people.
Well, when you study taste in children, you realize that as a group, they're living in different sensory worlds than us. Both the child and the young teenager have sensory systems that are really going to draw them to sugar and salt and avoid bitters.
So yes, in general, children do have a preference for sweet things over bitter things like coffee.
And this makes sense. The child is born into this world preferring that which they need to survive. Sweet is our signal for calories, which are sources of energy. And it's also the predominant quality of human milk. And for bitterness, it may be that the child has this biology to particularly warn against that which is potential toxins, because that's what bitter taste really is a signal for in many cases.
But she says it's not so simple as just sweet good, bitter bad, end of story. A lot of our taste preferences are learned.
Like all learning, it's repeated exposure that builds on the familiar. Children will learn 8 to 10 exposures to a food will increase their acceptance of the food. What mother eats, what siblings eat, what friends eat, the context of eating, all play a role in defining whether you grow to like it or not. You learn to like the foods you eat.
So repetition and cultural context, they are big parts of determining what foods and drinks we like. And they can override that predisposition against bitterness. We know this because there are places on Earth where kids do like bitter drinks.
Look at Argentina and mate. You know, at around 2 years of age, the child's being exposed to this tea and grows to like mate. It's a beautiful example of a cultural practice.
In 1961, the Pan American Coffee Bureau said it was time to invent their own cultural practice. I mean, they'd done it before, right? They turned the coffee break into an American institution out of practically nothing. Surely they could do it again and engineer a teenage craze. And the craze was going to be decorated coffee mugs.
Paint a couple of hearts onto coffee mugs. It's so much fun. Hang them on the wall, side by side. The two hearts become one.
But nobody became mugmates.
painting your little coffee mugs so that your girlfriend could have hers and you could have yours, I don't think it was compelling or convincing in the least. So it was, you know, a lame attempt to try to engage that generation of young people, but it failed miserably.
Except for some reason in Japan, where it became a minor hit. But the Mugmates campaign just did not get at what American teenagers wanted. And look, I sympathize. I don't know how to interact with teenagers. They remain terrifying ciphers to me. And I think it takes a pretty savvy marketer to understand how to reach them. The corporate men at the Pan American Coffee Bureau were clearly not that. So it's not that teenagers can't be turned onto crazes by Madison Avenue or by songwriters. Clearly they can. But they won't be pandered to. And that all began at this historical mid-century moment, when teens realized that they could decide what crazes they would adopt or reject. That the kids held the power, not them.
Them?
The adults, honey. This isn't their world anymore. It's gonna be ours.
So is there an alternate timeline where coffee got there first with better ads and created the Folgers generation? I don't know, but they didn't. And the consequence for the coffee industry was that the image of coffee stayed the same. A boring, gross drink for square grown-ups. And then Starbucks happened. Marketing fun-sounding, sugary drinks like mocha cookie crumble frappuccinos. And that's coupled with the rise of trendy coffee shops selling pour-overs of single-origin roasts. In the last few decades, there has been a revolution in the image of coffee.
Coffee has become the hip drink for young people, and they're willing to pay a lot of money for a latte or a cappuccino or cold brew nitro coffee, that sort of thing.
These days, coffee consumption among teens has been trending up, and soda consumption is going down. So, mission accomplished. Except,
why would anybody want to take away from the sugar-sweetened beverage industry of colas to make kids drink more coffee when they should be drinking neither of them? They're going to get addicted to the psychoactive components, which could have side effects on insomnia, on nervousness, on jitterness, on hyperactivity, on stomach aches. Am I missing something?
Fair point. So maybe it was a good thing, ultimately, that teenagers never actually had a Mugmates craze. That, as far as I can tell, the only person the campaign ever reached was me, more than a half century later. And now, I guess, you. So, let's be Mugmates.
So let's be Mugmates. Yay, 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 Mugmates. Whoa, 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 Mugmates. Yeah, yeah. Means we're in love.
Studio 360's Evan Chung produced that story. Gabriel Roth read the excerpt from the Tea and Coffee Trade Journal.